When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Hey, welcome to another episode of This Life. Bob Forrest.
Here I am.
Here we are. I'd like to introduce you all to our latest sponsor. It is the Rocky Mountain Treatment Center. They're in Montana. And if you've been listening to anything that Bob and I have been talking about over the years, you know that we're very particular about an addiction treatment. We don't take recommendations lightly, so we've looked into these guys pretty carefully. And the Rocky Mountain Treatment Center happens to be one I am able to recommend, and I'm happy to do so. They focus on individualized treatment of the patients, including their entire well-being based on a biopsychosocial model. This is what Bob and I have done for years and years. They don't just look at addiction. They look at the psychiatric issues, the psychological issues, the trauma issues, all aspects of the physical and mental health. And of course, you've heard me stress the importance of this for long-term success. There's staying sober, but there's what I call real recovery, which is dealing with all the risk factors that set people up for bad addiction. They're in Great Falls, Montana. It's a 26-bed facility surrounded by amazing Montana landscape. Patients can have a range of recreational therapies, including equine therapy. For more information on Rocky Mountain Treatment Center, click on their banner on the thislifepodcast.com website or at drdrew.com, or visit their site at rocky.rehab. That is simply rocky.rehab. And our special guest today, once she finishes sipping on that water, is the great Jennifer Ketchum. Jenny, how are you?
I am doing well, thank you. How are you both doing?
I'm good. I lived in your apartment.
What?
I lived in her apartment. I told you that. She was moving out of this really dope apartment where Sam lived when we first got together. I said, oh, let's just get that apartment.
Oh, I did not know this.
Yes.
Did you worked with Jenny on Sober House, right?
Yeah.
But that was...
But she was like a counselor by then.
Well, I mean, she was just engaged, really.
She was better than the house manager, let's say.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Jenny always done well. But tell a story about how you came in wanting to fuck everything up.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that is really kind of the key, is that I definitely didn't intend to do well when I came in. I just intended to write penises on the wall with toothpaste and, you know, have sex with the crew, but that didn't work out so well.
Oops.
Thankfully.
She said when we caught her attention was by calling her by her real name, her God-given name.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really interesting. It's, you know, it had been like 8 years since I had really used the name Jenny, and so...
So I don't know the industry you were in, but there's a lot of my friends have stage names, but everybody calls them by their real names.
Well, I think what's even weirder is that most people that have any sort of celebrity have a name that's not theirs.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's like, I don't know if either of you know anything about the studies on like anonymity and how, like, if there's police and riot gear, they're more likely to use like extreme violence than if they're not. And so this idea that, like, if we're protected by something, then we're more likely to do things that we otherwise wouldn't.
Oh, that's interesting. So it gives you sort of a veneer of anonymity. Yeah.
So you could come in as Penny, you could come in and put penises on and have sex with the crew.
Yeah.
But as Jenny, you can't.
No.
There you go.
And as Jenny, I had nothing.
Well, I met Jenny by the time you were in Sober House, you were pretty stable compared to your crew there.
Mm-hmm.
Staff included.
Yeah, I mean, relative to my cohort in the Sober House, I think I was definitely stable.
And you'd been working with Reef Kareem by that point, right?
How long
of a gap? Because I'm interested. You know, my thing is the 90 days. The brain actually starts to semi-function.
She'd been about 3 or 4 months sober, right?
Yeah. So
yeah, I actually
so
celebrated
the drug
90
addict,
days.
But yeah, so the drug so addict crew that was coming in with you to Sober House, they were only sober like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So it was really like treatment.
Like using there. So.
Oh, no. Well,
yeah.
Who was using? I forget.
Steven.
Oh, right.
Right?
Well, Carrie Ann, actually. She ended up, I mean, she got the boot, but.
Yeah. Carrie Ann was such a frustrating problem because not only would she was so awful when she was on stimulants, but doctors kept giving her Adderall.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
But a lot of it was Hollywood. I don't know if it was the name so much, but when I went to Oregon to visit Carrie Ann, she wasn't necessarily sober, but she was much more poised.
When she's off the meth and off the Adderall, she's so much better. That's why I would look at myself working with her. I go, why did I have such a ease and sort of almost affection for her as a person? I thought, oh, because when she wasn't using, I had compassion for her.
So when she was smoking marijuana, she was
fine.
Right.
Way better than the meth.
Okay. Because that's what she was doing.
Yeah. Good times. So, Jenny, a lot of people aren't aware of your... I think the people that saw you on the Sex Rehab and Sober House were aware of the sexual history, but how about the substance history?
Yeah, I mean, the substance history for me was pretty substantial. I mean, I started smoking pot when I was, I think the first time I smoked pot was 11 or 12, and it was pretty continuous from there on until I entered rehab, actually. And then, you know, alcohol was a pretty consistent thing in my story. And I think the first time I blacked out drinking was when I was 14. And then consistently throughout, I just thought that's what you did, right? When you had a great time, you just didn't remember having a great time.
But I mean, in your former industry, I mean, isn't it high? It's got to be like 80%. Like, I would think everyone I've ever met from that industry is fucked up.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of drug and substance.
Yeah,
abuse,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly a higher rate of people who are using than, say, another industry like the banking industry or, you know, I don't know, you know. But, I think a lot of it goes back to if you don't have adequate self-care mechanisms and you're entering into that business, then you're going to find things that are quick and easy, and drugs are generally pretty quick and pretty easy. And so
and
that
it
ends
anesthetizes
up being the self-care.
You it doesn't anesthetize you from dude, because I you know, I've been known to watch porn, and you can see in people's eyes they're just high out of their minds.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Very, very true. I sure do.
so anyways, sure do. Here's a good thing for your new career. Drew discovered that boys 18, 22, 24, 26 are not engaging in real relationships because they have you porn in their lives. They don't really need a real person.
Or they at least are retreating to that without sort of navigating the difficulty.
They don't have to deal with drama.
Yeah, they call it drama, and they'll say people are crazy or difficult, and they'll just sort of retreat to the internet.
Because they're human beings.
The process addiction.
Yeah. What's so amazing about that is that I think drama gets confused with, like, rejection and the potential and, like, normal human interactions and ways of, like, navigating those interactions.
Yeah, that's right. They just retreat from it. They retreat from it and then don't develop a skill or facility for it.
Well, some days you get your needs in a relationship. Some days you get your needs met. Some days you meet somebody's needs, and some days it's mutual.
But when you're adolescent,
young boys don't. Yeah. They're not adolescents. They're grown adults. They're 24 years old, Drew.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's what I get angry about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
we
got
to stop giving them a pass because they're, you
know.
No,
I
call it the Kobe Bryant syndrome. Every time he was an asshole, it was like, oh, he's only 27.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, no, he's a grown adult. So start acting like one. We need to get back to fundamentals. Yeah. I know that you like psych, but fundamentals are good too.
But so, well, Jen, what are you focusing on right now in your studies?
Right. So I've just finished all of the coursework for my master's in social work, which is super exciting. I am specializing in mindfulness-based and acceptance-based therapies. Yeah, I really like the portability and the widespread applicability for, I think mindfulness and acceptance-based therapies really kind of cross all cultural lines that exist in the world, right? Like, it's not like you're asking somebody to adopt this way of thinking. And it's, I mean, as much as it has,
universal,
religious roots.
Universal, yeah. What population do you want to deal with? What kind of population?
So I've been doing some work with people struggling with addictive behaviors and substance behaviors. I'm actually right now running a mindfulness-based relapse prevention group out of the Poly Clinic, which is this big hospital up in Seattle.
For young adults?
And then...
Young adults?
It's actually pretty diverse, the group of people. I think the youngest person that we have in the group is, like, I want to say, like, 24, 25. So still in that young adult range. And then the oldest person, she was in her mid-60s. So,
wow, that's a big cross-section. That's like a Las Encinas cross-section.
Yeah, that's what we used to have.
That's like a psych hospital.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a primary care hospital, and it just so happens that behavioral health is co-located within the hospital, which ends up being this really neat thing because people who probably otherwise wouldn't go to get mental health treatment now have access to it because it's much more normalized, you know.
Well, right. Obamacare too kind of fixes something.
Are you going to get a LCSW license?
Yeah. Fantastic. Ultimately, that's the goal. Yeah. Fantastic.
And so then when you get that, what I'm saying is most people I know that are getting those things, mm-hmm. they either want to work with children, adolescents, addicts. Mm-hmm. There's a big thing. They don't necessarily want to deal with them, but there's big money in dealing with baby boomers, elderly. Mm-hmm. Do you know this? So people are going into careers with either a codependent nature of who they want to rescue and save or a selfish nature of where they can make money.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Drew likes the nuttier.
Ugh, I don't like that.
Dude, I deal with them all the time. They're interns at Acadia.
Great.
And a
lot of people want to get involved with children. I just say it really takes a fucking tough soul to deal with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't think that I could deal with kids. I mean, I have a lot of my colleagues are working in CPS, and the stories that they tell,
unbelievable.
My heart breaks. Yeah, I don't know that I mean, I have really solid boundaries, and I don't know that I have that sort of emotional bandwidth to handle that sort of, like, I don't know if I could handle that sort of secondary trauma.
Yeah.
To thine own self be true. That's a wise girl.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to working with specific populations, I mean, you know, like I mentioned, with the focus in mindfulness, I think I want to open myself to very diverse populations. I am kind of digging on the idea of working with organizations and finding ways to integrate mindfulness work into the organization's culture.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so that people can find more happiness in their work environments and start to create more separation between work and, like, personal life. It's that work-life balance is so challenging, right? I mean, that was my biggest challenge in the adult life, is that there was no work-life balance, you know? Yeah. It was all work, and it just generalized to, like, this is my life. My life is my work, and so...
We just saw Amber Smith a little while ago, and she was asking...
How is she?
She's doing amazing. She's actually
doing
amazing.
Great.
Yeah. She, too, wants to do sort of a deeper therapy and stuff. She's having a little trouble with some feelings of longing and some still going for intensity in her relationships a little bit, but it's way less. Way, 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 way less.
Yeah.
But she was asking about your relationships.
About my relationships?
Yeah.
I mean, I got married. I mean, I did that vow of celibacy thing. I took it super seriously.
You did the sex addiction celibacy treatment. You did a circle plan.
Yep, I did circle plan. I did 10 months or so of celibacy. But when I finally did end up getting into a relationship, I mean, I remember when Jill said to me, she's like, well, you know, so generally people don't get into a relationship in their first year in recovery. And I was like, sweet, that's no problem. And then it took me like 10 minutes for it to set in that what she meant is that people don't have sex. Like, wait. Does that mean
that's not a relationship?
I'm cracking
up. That's what I said.
I'm just remembering with Jenny, we used to have these redirects. You'd count. You'd go 1, 2, 3, 1, 3. Jenny was all the time. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
Exactly. So, I mean, there were all sorts of things that I realized as soon as I entered into, like, the rehab world. Like, it didn't occur. I don't know if I told you this, Drew, but it didn't occur to me that I wouldn't be allowed to drink in rehab because I was like, well, it's sex rehab. Of course they'll let you drink. Like, you're not here for booze, right?
Booze.
They do on the surreal life. So
wait. I want to finish up. So your relationships, how did you get the ability to tolerate intimacy and be stable and that kind of stuff? How'd that go?
You know, when I when my husband and I got into our relationships, I was very honest with him. I had this like moment of like crazy courageous vulnerability and said, listen, I'm a horrible communicator and it's something that I really want to work on. And he had, I think, probably the same sort of very courageous, brave moment and was like, I too am a horrible communicator, you know? So it just setting that sort of precedent in the very beginning of our relationship, we made the explicit intention to work on our communication skills. And so as the relationship has developed, you know, we've continued to be really frank and honest about our feelings, but still try and share things in a way that isn't harmful or derogatory or passive aggressive.
I remember you waited a long time to have physical intimacy too, didn't you?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, we had been dating we talked on the phone for like a month before we even went on a date, and then I think we were dating for like 2 months before we were physically intimate. So it, you know, the trajectory of easing into a relationship was really antithetical to what I was doing before. You know, before it was like sleep with somebody immediately, figure out whether it's worth it to date them after that, you know, and this was like figure out if you like this person and then think about sleeping with them, you know.
Shocking.
And yeah. What does he do? How did he take for the transition up there? He's from LA too?
He was. Well, originally he's a Midwest guy. He was working in LA as a production person. And so he was trying to navigate this Hollywood space. I was kind of easing my way out of Hollywood and figuring out what it is that I want to do that's going to be sustainable and, you know, provide joy for me. And, in our relationship, you know, I started going back to school and he kept working in Hollywood and you know, the more that he dug into Hollywood, I think the more he realized that it wasn't really serving him in the way that he had idealized, right, as a young man. So when I got into University of Washington's master's program, it was a pooch.
I know.
When I got into University of Washington's master's program, he was all about it. His family is from Bellingham, which is just about
it's right there.
Close, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So he was like, let's do it. Let's go. Let's follow this dream. And he is, I mean, now that I'm finishing the kind of educational portion of my career development, he's really getting to dig into what he wants to do. And so he's actually, right now he's a bartender at the W Hotel, and he started working towards his sommelier certification.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he just passed his first one.
Is he going to be a master somm? You seen that documentary?
I know. I love it. And then they also have are you talking about Uncorked?
Somm. It's called SOMM, yeah.
Yeah, awesome, awesome. That's actually one of the things that really inspired him. Was
wow.
Like, yeah, so. But it ends up being very funny because he's, you know, so he's a bartender, and then I'm working kind of on the opposite end of that spectrum, and he'll
with the people the
like,
next day in the psych ward.
Yeah, so he'll be like, I, you know, there's a woman, and I'm pretty sure that she's off her meds, and she wants beer, and I'm like, babe, serve her a beer. You know?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Don't worry about it.
which brings up the cannabis issue. How's that going up there? Washington's changed its laws and stuff.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
There's psychosis in the hospital.
There's just weed everywhere. You know, for lack of a better way to put it, it's like walking down the street. People, you know, you smell weed pretty much everywhere. Hallways, you smell weed. You complain to the landlord, and it's like, well, it's legal, and it's like, and I don't care. Like, we're. Anyway, so
but what about adolescent admits to the psych hospital? Is it gone up? Do they see kids coming in like we used to see it at Los Angeles? They're like paralyzed because they're like 14. They just smoked this high potency THC pot and they didn't know what they were doing. That's what we saw.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, kids in the Seattle and Washington area are messing around with some pretty heavy drugs, and pot is really kind of the least of their worries up
really?
Here. You know, it's
what are you seeing mostly?
About,
pills?
A lot of pills, a lot of heroin, a lot of, so a lot of oxy and a lot of heroin is like pretty much.
At 14?
It's awful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It's really, really bad. And there's been some sightings of this new drug, Crocodile.
Oh yeah. Is that up there now?
Yeah. So pretty gnarly.
Yeah. Is it stimulants? Are they big?
Stimulants for the kids. It's mostly depressants.
Huh.
Yeah.
So pain. It's the pain. The trauma stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive.
And the weather.
Yeah, exactly. I would want a stimulant. I mean, if I was going to use something in shitty weather, it's going to be, you know.
That's what I would think. That's why I think trauma is the opiate drug. I mean, people have pain. They're carrying pain around. They're trying to escape it. That's opiates.
Yeah.
There's so much depression up there. It's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, there really is. It's pretty scary. We have a really high suicide rate up here, and
Now that you're deep into the professional experience, you know, as a mental health professional, what are your concerns? What do you see? What does the landscape look like? Because we're old timers. We're starting to sound like crotchety old men. We're worried about everything.
But I'm back to the basics. Get a goddamn job.
Right. That we're seeing a lot of real primitive dysfunction.
Primitive.
Like they're primitive.
Non-functioning.
Can't function in the world, can't work or won't work and can't have relationships. These are the sort of things that they're concerning us now.
Yeah, like are you talking about like a lot of like failure launch type of stuff?
Yes,
But the failure
to function, I call it. Not just launch, failure to have social networks, failure to have interpersonal relationships, failure to have even hope of a job or a separate
Bob will say
life.
Things like, you know, don't you, what inspires you? What do you
want to
do?
Why don't you go to Costa Rica? And they're like, why would I go there?
The scariest thing they say to Bob now is, I don't know, what do you want me to do?
What am I supposed to do?
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I would get on your old-timer bandwagon. Yeah, I really
so see the Great Northwest doesn't have that. They have high suicide. They have depression.
No, she's saying yes. She's saying the same thing.
But are they up there, those kids? Because I think the Great Northwest has this tough-ass psyche to it that, like, you'll survive. You don't see that?
The population that I work with is I think it's kind of different. So it's really hard for me to make a sort of
I'm like thinking of musicians comparison. I know from up there. You know what I mean? They're like hard asses. They're tough. They live in the snow. They fucking don't give a fuck. They hate LA. People in Seattle hate LA more than any people in this country. When I go there, people don't even talk to you.
That's actually called the Seattle freeze, and that is just it's a legitimate phenomena, and I think it's probably even has a Wikipedia page. It would not surprise me. That's actually a real thing, and that happens to anybody who comes in from the outside. Unfortunately, it's like actually a real like I have experienced the Seattle freeze, and I still experience it. And I've been here for like two and a half years. So.
But you do see the same phenomena Bob's talking about, though.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm also a writing tutor at the University of Washington, and I work with a lot of undergraduate students as well as students in the master's program. And, you know, so I'm seeing a lot of students who are really just kind of like, I don't know what I want. So I see it.
And they're in the University of Washington.
Yeah.
It's amazing to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I knew what I wanted since I was 11.
Really?
Yeah. I want to live life. I want to seize life by the throat and go live it. I want to meet people. I want to go do things. Things are rad. The universe is rad.
Well, there was a desire, really intense desire to get out. As Howard Stern said, he tunneled out of his parents' house. And I thought, that's what I felt. I felt like I was tunneling out. Like, I can't fucking get out of here fast enough.
Yeah.
And go see things. You know, something that comes up a lot. You know, we're talking about also as you're aging and what you want in life and all that. I don't really want to go anywhere because I found the places that I like to be.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Kids are saying
but you
that.
Have to. I like Joshua Tree. I like the escape of the intensity of LA for about 48 hours, and then I like this shit. You know what I mean? And so I figured it out. I've been everywhere, and I lived in a lot of places, and that's what life as a young adult is, to go figure
experiment.
out. And they don't have that passion. And that frustrates me.
You know what? I honestly think one of the biggest problems is, and probably a really big contributing factor is like internet addiction and time spent online. Because it's like, you know, that wasn't an issue when you were younger. You actually had to leave your parents' house to see what the world looks like. And now you have everything at your fingertips.
She's right.
And so you get this sort of like this false sense that you've been everywhere. I can look at the Eiffel Tower, I can go to like all of the seven wonders of the world in the next 5 seconds, and I don't have to leave my living room, right? And so there's this
that's weird, right?
False sense that you actually get to experience life because you have all of this stuff in your fingers. And the reality is that the more time you spend in your phone, the less time and the less courage you're going to have to actually spend out in the real world, because you could face rejection there.
Are these your observations, or is this an object of conversation in your program?
So it's definitely a little bit of both, right? Mm-hmm. So in my practice at Polyclinic, a lot of my work is bringing people out of their their technology and like starting to live in the world. That's what a lot of my mindfulness practices is about.
Well, I was going to say, it's no wonder you're attracted to mindfulness, because it's really just getting people back in their body.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
back connected to themselves. Forget other people. See, it's funny. Bob and I are all about connecting to other people, that we forget they got to be connected to their own body first.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, wow.
When you just said that, that's what I'm thinking. Like, I want to inspire and be inspired and have these relationships I've had with so many thousands of people through the decades.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to have them with these 20-year-olds, and they don't know how to have them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they don't have one with themselves. And
yep.
So they're really lacking this sort of...
So maybe our parents didn't do so bad.
We
had some sort of sense of self.
Yeah.
Well, but to be fair, if these kids were hit with what we were hit with and the internet, we would be totally fucked up.
Yeah. Probably.
That's wild.
Jenny, you were growing up when? In the 90s?
I was born in 83. So in the 90s.
Because her story is very vivid to me. And have you ever heard? Do you ever hear her story with how her mom used to leave her with her brother? And do you know this, Bob?
Oh yeah, that happens a lot. When that happened to a lot of kids in the '80s and nineties.
Yeah,
leaving 7-year-olds with the 9-year-old to watch them all day.
Ugh. Yeah, yep, yep. Give them $20 and they'll figure out dinner on their own.
My little sister was raised like that.
Ooh.
Yeah,
she would go to 7-Eleven to get my sister mom cigarettes when she was like 7.
Jeez. Yeah, it creates this really weird dynamic then as you and your siblings grow into adults, because I've had to do a lot of like renegotiating with both of my siblings around like, I can't be mom anymore.
Were the oldest? I thought you were younger.
Yeah. No,
I'm the oldest.
I only remember your brother. Who's the other sibling?
So I also have a little sister. She is 5 years younger than me, and then my brother's 7 years younger.
Your brother was in the Marines, right?
He was. He is no longer. He was honorably discharged. He actually ended up going to rehab and getting sober, too.
Oh, my gosh. Very cool.
So let me ask you this. Yeah. So you were, what age did your mom say, well, Jenny, you're old enough to take care of your sister and brother, so at what age was that?
Well, so it was less like you're old enough to take care of your sister and brother, and it was more like, I'm divorcing your dad, you're going to do the parenting while I go and do... I mean, my mom has some pretty substantial alcohol and, you know, issues, to say the least.
So, but we go back to that first couple of times. So she's going out to drink.
Yeah.
You're how old? 9, 8, 7?
Like,
10?
Well, so 12, I think, 12, 13 was when the responsibility of child rearing really became
getting them up in the morning, fine. Getting them to school, all of that.
Well, she would take us to school, but it was always a drop off after school, and then she would leave again until very, very late at night. And then, you know, the what happened between the time we got dropped off and the time she would come home would be all
you were in charge.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Dinner and all that.
Yeah, I mean, if you could call, it's dinner. I'm not going to downplay
popcorn. Popcorn.
Yeah, I mean, walk to Burger King and whatever you can get for $20.
I'm telling you, that was a lot of people of that generation's story. That's my little sister's story.
Yeah.
Sheesh.
She used to get herself up in the morning at like 8 and make her own breakfast and walk to school. My mom'd still be in bed.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was just accepted, Drew. It was worse than the 70s. Well,
I remember some of that.
It was called Latchkey Kids.
Yeah, the Latchkey thing was a big
one. You were a Latchkey kid.
Yeah, it's still called Latchkey.
But is it still going on? I don't think the parents are going anywhere anymore. I think they just
I think CPS gets going quicker.
I think it's probably still going on quite a bit more than we would expect. It's just being talked about. I think there's also this phenomena where parents have stopped really, like, before you give the kids, you know, the older sibling raises the kids, right?
Yeah.
Or whatever that dynamic is. Now you give them an iPad and then the iPad raises the kids, right?
So
there's still this really giant disconnect. Parents on the phone the whole time. Now the kids are on the phone the whole time. And so everybody's just kind of, you know, sedated and not really participatory and dealing with the normal interactions of, I love this dog.
I think the dog has to pee. Does it have to pee?
No, he wants attention. He's just
I was giving him attention.
Everything's about him. Everything's about him. Come here, Rex. Come here. Say hi to him.
Come on, buddy.
Hi, puppy.
Do you see him?
Come on.
Oh, what a pooch.
Come on.
Oh, now he's going to
up, up.
Hi, puppy.
Come here.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. He's distracting.
So sweet.
But now, having reared your brothers and sisters as you did, I've noticed that some people that go through that then become aversive to having children for themselves. Have you had that experience? Or you?
Well, I didn't want kids for a long time, yeah. And I think that probably played into it. But you know, I was also pretty self-destructive, and so the idea that I could raise anybody, let alone myself, was just kind of not realistic at that time. Now I definitely want kids. And
oh, good.
And we plan on having kids. It's just a matter of
when.
Yeah, exactly. And just about to, you know, get the degree and be able to actually practice and have a career. I'd like to do a little bit of that before making a human.
Are you coming back down here? Are you going to stay up there?
I think we're going to stay up here. I mean, my dad is down by Portland, which is just about 3 hours south of us. And then, you know, his parents are up in Bellingham, an hour and a half north. And my sister's living down with my dad. I think my brother's moving back with my dad.
Have you reconciled with your dad?
I have. Oh, yeah. We're very close.
Wow.
We're very close.
Crazy,
yeah.
Actually, right?
Yeah, it is wild. And then I don't talk to my mom anymore.
Okay, so that's an interesting journey. So when you were a kid, you thought your dad abandoned you, this motherfucker, and at least she's here. She's a fuck up, but at least she's here, though she's not raising you. And the full circle is to realize there's reasons why marriages fall apart and da-da-da and start to have forgiveness for everybody. The alcoholic mother, him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's what we talk about a lot. It's not forgiveness in that quaint way, wrap it up, tie it up in a bow, but to understand.
Yeah.
Mindfulness of what they were, why they ended up traumatizing you because they're trauma survivors and this. We got to break these chains that bind.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I look back and I don't know that I ever felt that my dad abandoned me. I mean, there were, I think what ended up happening, and I kind of knew this at the time, but, you know, my mom always shared far more information with us about their divorce and about my father's behaviors in their divorce, far more information than is appropriate to share with young kids, you know? And so what I think happened is that I got mad at my dad about stuff that he was doing in the divorce, and you know the guy's hurt. And so Bob, I totally agree with you and like being able to look back and be like, oh, you were doing that because you were hurt. But I never felt like he abandoned me, you know. In reality, I knew my mom left my dad and he was reacting in pain. And I think she was for me a more safe place to be emotionally than to face the loss of identifying with my dad. Because if I were to take sides with my dad, then I would have to experience that hurt of the family breaking apart, right? Whereas if I take sides with my mom, I get to leave and I get to be the one that decides. And you know, I mean, there's a lot of other unhealthy things there. But, you know, when my dad and I finally,
What did he say? What did he say the first time you talked about it?
Well, so I didn't talk to him for about... I actually just started talking to him the year that I went into rehab. That was, I hadn't talked to him for a good, like, I don't know, I want to say between like 12 and 8 years, 8 to 12 years. I didn't talk to him, just not in his life. And then, you know, when I called him on New Year's, the beginning of 2009 and said, you know, I want to, I want to work on this relationship. And that was really a turning point. And he said, you know what? We'll just keep talking to each other. We don't have to do anything. We don't have to say anything. We'll just keep making the phone call and picking up the phone. And that was really a key turning point for both of us. And then I made amends to him, you know, and my amends to my dad wasn't like, I forgive you for being human. It was like, I'm sorry that I cut you out of my life for so long, you know, because that's really what it was.
Mm-hmm. That's a true amends.
Did you
understand what she was saying? A lot of 12-step amends are, you know, I'm sorry I was, resented you.
Right,
that's
right.
Not really an amend.
Or I'm sorry you pissed me off.
Yeah, I'm sorry that you're such an asshole that I had to remove you from my life.
Right.
I try to tell people that all the time. Like, who, you know, I learned it doing them myself. When I had an amends go terribly wrong with the person told me to fuck off, right? So then I go back to my sponsor and he said, well, you did your part. And that just didn't feel complete enough. And I was talking to another 12-step friend of mine. And he goes, what's the principle you're trying to learn in the ninth step? And I said, forgiveness. And he goes, forgiveness of who?
Mm. Yeah, yourself.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And rather than to be forgiven or to forgive, you know, to forgive others as they trespass against us, we're all this. That's kind of the theme that Drew and I have been talking about through this whole podcast is, listen, trauma begets trauma, causes trauma.
Yep.
It's the responsibility of the adult with insight to heal as best you can yourself and stop the cycle of trauma on your children. And so for you to make this decision, when I'm whole, when I'm stable, when I have my career and I can take care of, I want a family. That's how you break it.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
It's hard though. It's a lot of work.
Yeah. It's taken quite a bit of work. I mean, unfortunately, you know, John Irwin and VH1 paid for a lot of the work that I got for a little bit.
I know people don't take that. People, I keep telling VH1 they need to take their hat, tip their hat for that because they paid for a lot of people's treatment well beyond the cameras rolling.
Paid for Amber's mom's treatment.
Did they really?
Yeah. Her medical treatment.
So much. That was, I think it was Irwin's inability to like say, you've done really something really nice, John.
That was not Irwin. That was VH1. That was VH1.
Really?
Yeah. That was VH1.
But I thought he had to fight for it.
No, I had to fight for it. I got news for you. I was the one. I was the one before anything started. I said, you've got to put this aside for aftercare, period. Yeah. And the problem was not everyone was willing to do it. And that's where. Yeah. That's where bad shit happens, you know.
Yeah. Or fortunately, they didn't do it, and I got to use up all of those funds.
Well, guess what? No, but this is something important for the public to know. Guess who didn't come to the aftercare provided to them? Mindy McCready. Rodney King. Jeff. Right?
Jeff. Oh, well, Jeff went right back to his doctors that prescribed.
Do you understand? I'm telling you, the people that failed and died never came to Hollywood Recovery Center. Not one time.
I know.
I'm not saying that me and Shelley or you or Cures are going to help, but it was just in the willingness to even come and hang out. Eric Roberts did for months.
Yep.
Jason Davis even did for months.
And so did...
And they're not dead.
No, I know.
But the people who didn't want anything to do with anything Drewby. After the show.
How about Drewby? I can't believe, you know, he's done okay.
Yeah, he talks to me still. You know what I'm saying? And that's what America needs to know. Aftercare is the whole trick of it. Maintenance and care and self-care. Well, that's the whole trick of it. Ongoing care.
I went for 3 years after the show. You know, I just kept showing up at Dr. Reeves and showing up at Jill's and doing whatever they said because everything I did made my life better. Like everything they recommended to me.
And by the way, they were asking you to do a lot.
Oh, yeah. There was one. And Dr. Reeves is really skilled at this. He's really skilled at saying something that is so innocuous. And you don't think anything of it at the time. And I remember one time he asked me, you know, do you think that your experience in the adult business was authentic? And I was like, of course it is. You know, everything is about me is authentic. You know? And then 2 weeks later, I'm like, oh, my God. Like, this is really what it is this whole like coming out into authenticity. And so, you know, these really skilled practitioners.
Right, targeted, those targeted moments. Yeah.
Who present you know, the work in that short period of time, but then it really is the patient who has to go home and do the work.
You know? He's pointing out the false sense of self, right? You think that's you, but he's just saying, hey, maybe that's not you. Are you sure that's you?
Yeah.
Sure that's a genuine you? Who is you?
Yeah.
Right. I remember my bi-therapist just asked me once, I was sort of like rambling on. I went, I don't know why you're sitting here listening to me. I don't know what you get out of this. She goes, what do you think I get out of this?
Nice.
And I was like, whoa. Yeah. I was like, oh, shit.
Wow.
She was like, came in perfect time. And she's like, zoom, right in me. I was like,
Roland Kim said the same thing to me. I was talking about myself, like, everybody loves me and everybody, you know, I'm the greatest guy and blah, blah, blah. And that's, you know, and that's, and it's like, it's not me. And he goes, that's not how I see you. And I went, well, how do you see me? He goes, you have severe depression, dysthymia. I don't see you as happy. And I was like, everybody sees me as happy. What the fuck are you talking about?
Why don't you see me as happy?
That's rapport. That's a wonderful, that is well-built rapport.
But it was crushing that he saw the real me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Depressive, suicidal, always getting nobody
appreciating. All three of us told stories about being seen.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Those are all three stories about somebody seeing us.
But I thought he was seeing me as a happy guy that's kind of a little neurotic.
You still can't let it go. You're still fucked up about it.
It was so spot on.
But being genuinely, authentically seen is what we're all talking about.
Yeah. And also doing the work outside of therapy. You don't just go to therapy for 45 minutes a week and then, you know, for 8 weeks or whatever. You don't just go to rehab for 21 days and then your life is magically better. It's like Bob was saying, it's an issue of maintenance. You have to keep doing the work once you leave. Otherwise, none of it matters.
That's right. There's two aspects of maintenance. Maintenance of the work and then maintenance of change.
The thing that happen is it's a constant moving target. So you can do a relationship well for 3 or 4 years or 2 or 3 years, and you're doing all the things maintenance wise. And as soon as you think you've got it made, or you really have insight and you're not attentive or not changing or not paying attention even, it all just somehow just force it back to be the every relationship I've ever had. And that's what I just went through, a divorce last year, and it was horrible and sad for my son. But I recognize that I just thought I was so well, which maybe I was for a couple of years. And then I just let the foot off the gas and just back to the natural default setting. That you ever see that David Foster Wallace lecture called This Is Water? About a default setting. You should watch. It's my favorite thing. It's like he talks about, we all have this default setting, which I think is the tendency we have, or the personas we create through trauma. So we have a default setting, either people pleaser or world's critic or emotionally unavailable. Yeah. We just have these default settings, and we'll go back to them no matter how far you think you've come. They're so ingrained in us. Mm. You know, that was my experience.
I think the common misperception is that, you know, I think what you really touched on, Bob, and I'm so sorry that you've been going through a really hard time, and I imagine divorce is probably one of the hardest things to go through.
With a kid, it's hard. I've done it without a kid, and it's painful, but it's but
different.
With a kid, it's like nothing else. But. Now I can look back on where I just went back to my old tendencies, which is I'm okay and everything's okay.
Now that you're living outside the house.
When I look at when it started happening.
Ah.
You know what I mean? There were some stumbling moments in the beginning, but then it really got good. Like, we're on the same page. We're communicating. We're doing all these things. And then it's just like, okay, this is good. This is all right. Everything's fine. And just a not sticking with mindfulness of the relationship.
Huh.
Right?
Huh.
It was weird. It was almost like I was doing it right for the first time for a while. And then, okay, so it'll just continue going like this and I won't have to pay attention that much or ask how you're doing. You know, when you're in mindfulness, like she's talking about, that's Roland's thing. When I'm coming home, I don't want to come home with traffic was fucked, I just fucking dealt with a bunch of assholes all day long. I need an hour to myself. I come home and say, hey, how's everything going? And I engage with Elvis and her and be a family, right? Mm-hmm. Before I walk in the door.
Yeah.
After two years of that, you can just walk in the door and go, I had a fucking fuck day and I need an hour to watch basketball. For some reason, it was weird. I regressed back to my old self. Hmm. And I can see it now that I did that.
Huh. Well, here's the thing, and I think it's probably what's so challenging about practicing mindfulness. So mindfulness is defined by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's the father of like the mindfulness-based stress reduction program. He defines mindfulness as a particular way of paying attention, and that particular way is in the moment, intentionally and non-judgmentally, right? So for us to be mindful of any moment in our day, right? So say you have... like you have the shittiest day, right? You're in your head in that shitty day. You're somewhere else. You're thinking about all these other things. So then when you get home, you're in the past reviewing your shitty day, right? And mindfulness asks that you come in and you engage with your family, but you don't do it in a way that's like avoiding those feelings, right?
Right.
You can say like, I am really hurting right now, because you're mindful of that. You say, I am hurting. I had a hard day. And I'm just noticing that right now I'm in a lot of pain, and I just need to be here with you, or even to be alone, right? But to say like I need an hour to.
But Jenny, if I can interrupt, you're also being mindful of how you're coming across, mindful
describing.
Of how you're being received, mindful of what their needs are in that moment, and weighing all this out.
I remember coming home after a hard day, because all rehab days are kind of hard sometimes, and saying I'm so glad to be home.
Like that
home was sacred and different.
Sure.
And then it just started to become a complainathon, and I realized that. Oof. It's very peculiar how you can just justify anything.
Well, I think we habituate to things, right? Like we have Teflon for positive things, and we are Velcro for negative things, right?
So when
we have a crappy day, the crap just sticks to us. But little positive things, because for the most of the day, it's actually pretty neutral, right? Like, there's some big events, and some of them are really icky, but for the most of the day, it's just really neutral, and all of that just falls off of us. But these negative events really stick to us, and that's the stuff that we go over and over and over and over. And that's what they say that depression is living in the past, right? And then they say anxiety is living in the future, and then the practice of mindfulness is about being right now. So,
have you ever heard of this thing called nonviolent communication?
Yeah.
Using inclusive language. Have you ever seen the videos of the old psychiatrists that did that from the 70s? There's one good thing that came from the 70s, Drew. Ugh. Nonviolent communication.
Cinema.
Using inclusive language, that kind of way of communicating, especially in a team, right? And say, well, you know, you reflect on all of us, so let's all stick together here and kind of... And when you use that with addicts, they really let their guard down.
Yeah,
they really do, because they don't feel like you're pointing fingers at them. You need to do this. You need to do that. Why did you do this? Why did you do that? You're just like, you know, usually when I used to do that, it was usually because blah, blah, blah.
What?
You know what
because
I mean?
What?
Well, kids relapsing all the time. It's because I didn't stick with it long enough. Well, I have a lot of kids that are in the 90 day. They're about 90 days when they come to me. And then... at the 6-month point, if they don't do a lot of mindfulness and take it as serious as the first 90 days, they will screw up in that second 90 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they're not doing what's necessary for the second 90 days. They're just doing what's necessary for the first 90 days. Mm. Do you understand? And you got to get in there and say, you know, I used to do this all the time. I'd do good for 3 or 4 months and everybody get all the cash and prizes back or get everything back on track and gain everybody's trust back. And then I would just go get high.
You.
Yeah.
That was your thing.
Sharing with them so that they don't feel attacked. Like, you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. Da, 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 da.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, Bob, I think you touch on something that's really amazing with that inclusive language. And I think even more than making kids feel like they're not being judged, what it does is it provides the connection that many of us who struggle with addiction are looking for in the first place, right? Like, that's why I used, like, yeah, checking out was great. That was great. But ultimately, all of my efforts to get high involved an attempt to connect with somebody else. And I couldn't connect with myself, obviously, right? So when you're using this language that's like, why are we doing this? You know, it
why
really,
are we doing this?
Why are
it's
we
amazing.
Doing this?
It power brings, in that
us together. Like the antidote for addiction isn't always like sobriety. Sometimes it's just connection, right? Like sometimes we just want to know that we are actually a part of this thing all together.
Well, I always say connect to others, connect to self.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's included. I think the Dalai Lama, when he heard self-compassion for the first time, was like, what do you mean compassion doesn't involve like being compassionate toward yourself? And it's something that we really struggle with in the Western world.
You know, the Dalai Lama, the favorite quote, I saw him speak at the Wilton Theater here in LA years ago. And somebody in the audience asked him, what's wrong with the world? You know, like some Brentwood housewife, you know, brain drover that came over to see the Dalai Lama. What's wrong with the world? Well, that was the question from the audience. And he had a twinkle in his eye and he was sitting there and he said, lack of insight.
That's funny.
Lack of insight that you asked that question.
Right.
Lack of insight.
Into what we're doing here, what's going on.
It really answered the whole spectrum.
It's hysterical.
Lack of insight.
It's brilliant.
So,
well, we're kind of winding down. Jen, it's always, you know how inspired I am by you. What a pleasure it is to see your progress. And it's exciting. And just think the most of you and what you're doing. And it for me, you know, Bob, not you, but one Jennifer can carry me through many, many troubling cases.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because there's always hope. And particularly knowing that you came in with zero intention to get well and just getting you into the, because that's always what I've always felt is like if we could just get you in, we can do something.
There's something mysterious and magical that we'll never figure out. My intention, my first day sober, was I'm going to drink. I'm just not going to do drugs anymore. I haven't had a drink for 20 years.
Yeah, but
isn't that weird?
Well, you did drink after that, didn't you?
No.
I just remember my favorite story with you was going to AA with a six-pack.
Yeah, that was years before this.
Okay.
No, my first day of sobriety is coming up. Well, March 16th.
But I think the reason the alcohol stopped was that meeting. Tell Jenny what happened at that meeting.
Yeah, so I was trying to hawk a watch somebody bought me, and this friend of mine said, well, I'll give you a couple $100 for it if you go to an AA meeting with me. And I was like, fuck you, I'm not going to an AA meeting. I want to go to the liquor store.
And
he goes, I said, I'll go to the AA meeting with you if you buy me a six-pack of beer. And he said, okay. And so I drank the six-pack of beer in the AA meeting.
Amazing.
And nobody kicked me out. Nobody threw me away. And then as we were leaving after the meeting, everybody, like 200 people said, keep coming back, Bob.
And that cut through to you.
It really was. They would have thrown me out, I might have never come back. And I always try to tell people that, like, we can't throw people out. If we're going to throw them out, we're just sentencing them to death.
Yeah.
I mean, we all just want to be accepted, right?
Yeah. It was funny, too. I was laughing. It hurt when they were saying, keep coming back.
Yeah.
But also, I was laughing because it was so cool.
All right, my dear. Well, listen, good luck with you. We're here for you. Thank you for being a part of this and being such inspiration. And say hi to your husband for me.
Yeah, thanks, Drew. I don't know if I say it enough, but I just am so grateful.
Oh,
awesome. Well, keep on keeping on.
Thanks, guys.
Keeping you, dearie. It's just an inspiration. Yeah. You're an inspiration. So don't even just keep doing what you do. That's all you got.
Thank you, Drew.
All right, Jenny. Take care.
It's not a good time, but I will at some point have to tell you about this advocacy work that I'm doing with the AIDS Healthcare Foundation.
All right. Wait. AIDS, by the way, is how I got involved in media. That's the very thing that put me in media because no one was talking to young people about it back in the day. And that's why I got involved in radio. I don't know if you know that. Because I just thought, somebody's got to talk about this. I can't believe it. Because in that, it was 82 or 83, young people weren't having sex. I don't know if you're aware, but they just were not. As far as the public discourse was, they were not. And so you wouldn't talk to young people about AIDS. Why? They're not having sex. I thought, you got to be fucking kidding me. They need to know about this. And so that's I did that for 10 years.
I didn't know that. So I'm starting to do some advocacy work with the AIDS Healthcare Foundation around getting condoms required in pornography because it's no longer like a moral issue. It's like a workers' right issue, right? So Cal/OSHA and all these other organizations are getting involved. And so I get to do like state level
Yeah, you have to go state to state. I've been following that, and you have to go state to state because as California insists on it, then they go to Nevada. You need Nevada. You need power. You need that kind of consensus. This is just something that has to happen.
All right, Jenny.
Condoms and porn.
We're gonna run. We'll see you soon.
Okay. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Keeps you going, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's hundreds of people like that.
Hundreds, there's millions of them in my heart, I believe.
But that we've dealt with.
Yeah.
I saw Pam. Remember the woman Pam from the Los Encinas? She's sober 7 years.
Wow.
I saw her at Trader Joe's the other day. I see all the people everywhere.
Pam's
you
we
see
thought,
him,
we thought she
you?
Was going to die, right?
Yeah, we for sure thought she was going to die.
Well, listen, we whine and cry about a lot of stuff. We have a lot to be grateful for. So,
yeah.
And Jenny's one of those things. So
there you go.
Hey, and a reminder, everybody, you can check out thislifepodcast.com. You can find the podcast there as well as at podbayfm.com. And a reminder, today's episode is courtesy of Rocky Mountain Treatment Center. Also, if you want to support it, please go to drdrew.com and click through on the Amazon banner. That helps us out, too. Doesn't cost you a thing, but keeps a little wind in the sails here. We'll see you next time.
Are you my sun, my earth? 'Cause it feels like we can't live without each other. Is it this life or the one before? I feel tired of you in ways I can't ignore. Keep wondering, but I wanna know for sure. Illuminated, so you and I. We're free.